Welcome to Solder Smoke, a podcast about homebrew electronics and amateur radio. This is a program for people who like to melt solder and build their own rigs. For other episodes of the program, go to www.soldersmoke.com. For the latest Solder Smoke news, go to soldersmoke.blogspot.com. Please send feedback to n2cqr@yahoo.com. So, as we step away from our soldering irons and oscilloscopes, please join us for another edition of Solder Smoke. All right, guys, good morning. It's 1 April 2010. That makes this Solder Smoke 123. Sorry for the big delay. I really have a valid excuse this time. I had to make an unexpected trip. Kind of amazing things happened here this month, and I found myself in Chicago. Let me explain. I've been, to the annoyance of some of you, I've been out promoting the book Solder Smoke Global Adventures in Wireless Electronics, and I've been having a lot of fun with it. I had a lot of fun writing the book, and I've been really gratified with the response. And one of the amazing things that happens when you write a book is occasionally people approach you and ask you to come and talk about the book. And we recently had a really big one in this area. I want to thank the League's public relations folks who were involved in this. I think their interest is in promoting ham radio and getting the word out about our portion of the hobby. Also, there's a lot of interest in the new media, the internet aspects of this, because the book was published by Lulu and is kind of self-published, print-on-demand kind of product. And the way it's being promoted and the way it's being promoted on the blog and on the internet, well, all these things came together. And the next thing you know, I've been asked to go out to Chicago. And I think our American listeners will know what television program is headquartered in Chicago. And, man, it was amazing. But about 10 days ago, I found myself in a studio there, not alone, but with a bunch of other people who are involved in similar books, and promoting Solder Smoke, A Global Adventure in Wireless Electronics on Oprah. Can you believe this? I mean, Solder Smoke, it's not quite Oprah Book of the Month Club, but I got to go on Oprah and talk about solder smoke and melting solder and building electronic equipment and the excitement of technology and the ability of the internet and the new communication media to put this kind of product out. And I think it's great. I really didn't think that they would be interested in this kind of thing, but there you have it. So listen, I know you're all going to want to see it, and I've got the schedule. I know exactly when it's going to come out in different parts of the country and around the world. So check out the soldersmoke.com blog, and I'll have the information there on when the program will be broadcast in your area. There's a whole schedule, but I think you'll find it interesting, and it's certainly really unbelievable what happened. All right, that's enough of that. Enough book promotion, as I've been repeatedly told by by listeners and readers of the blog. I guess it's time to talk about the Equinox. Spring is springing here in Rome. We're getting reports not only from Rome but from throughout the Northern Hemisphere that spring is upon us. AA1TJ reports that the sap is flowing in Vermont. If you guys listen carefully, you might hear the birds singing out there in the background. I can hear birds singing here in the pre-dawn morning here in Rome. From up north, we're getting reports of amazing aurora activity in Norway. And we've just passed the equinox, and of course, here in March, here in Rome, the Ides of March. So spring is in the air. Before we get going today, I want to share with you a report from what I hope will be a new rite of spring. This is MassCon, a really interesting QRP a meeting that took place in the state of Massachusetts during the month of March. We had a correspondent there, our man Mark, NX1K was on hand to do some interviews and do some reports, and we have an audio clip from Mark and an audio message sent in from Michael AA1TJ. So before we kick off the festivities, let me go now to the clip to our report from the first ever MassCon QRP meeting. Take it away, Mark.
This is Mark, NX1K, at the end of the Massachusetts QRP convention on Saturday, March 13th, 2010, in rainy Westford, Massachusetts. This is the first ever MassCon, as it is called, and it was a very full day, with presentations starting at 8 in the morning and concluding about 9:15 in the evening after dinner and a speaker. The theme throughout the day was just do it and have fun. The talks were aimed at expanding our horizons and were full of exciting ways to increase our enjoyment of the hobby. Although many think of QRP as 40-meter CW, Allison, KB1GMX, challenged us to consider building and operating on VHF and UHF. Michael, AA1TJ, discussed some of his current and future projects with plenty of historic background as inspiration. Dave, NT1U, showed us the theory of filter design, and Bruce, N1RX, demonstrated how to realize those designs with real-world components and tolerances. George, N2APB, and Joe, N2CX, described experiments with a small 0.1 wavelength loop and compared it with a commercial product. Many around the hall weren't sure what to make of the loop they carried into the room to show us. Chuck N1TEV reintroduced us to some classic designs and tricks for controlling regenerative receivers and urged us to try at least one regenerative receiver project. Yes, Bill, regenerative radios can show us a bit of heaven. Dave, K1SWL, talked about his long interest in simple voice radios and described a new project from Small Wonders Lab for a 75-meter AM transceiver. Joe, K1JT, gave us some history of the WSJT protocols for weak signal communications. He combined technical details with recordings or transcripts of contacts and concluded with a live look at the Whisper Network. The dinner speaker was Steve, WG0AT, who introduced us to his two pack goats, Rooster and Peanut, and showed many interesting pictures and videos of hikes and QRP operations in the mountains of Colorado and elsewhere. There were about 75 attendees, and the interest level was very high. It was a great opportunity to see old friends and to meet new ones. I dare say we all look forward to the next one. All the presentations and some supplemental material will be posted on the convention website, www.masscon.org. Thanks to Scott, N1RD, and Greg, N1OB, for conceiving and organizing the conference. Thanks to the Westford Police Amateur Radio Team, PART, and to Buddy Pole, Inc., for their sponsorship of this great event. And thanks to Bill for his encouragement to make these notes and to pass them along for use on Solder Smoke.
Hello, Bill. This is Mike, AA1TJ, and I'm coming from the MassCon QRP convention. We're having a great time here. I think the people at Solder Smoke, a crowd, would really enjoy it. We've been just heard Chuck Kitchen talk about regenerative and super regenerative receivers. We're looking forward to a full afternoon of talks. So it's been wonderful. Bill, if I get out to Europe this summer, I hope to look you up. Maybe we can meet in Italy, which would be great. I plan to bring some little portable rig. Maybe it'll be hand generated, maybe not. The power that is. So take care, and all the best to you. Bye bye.
All right, that was beautiful. Thank you very much, Michael, and thanks. Thanks especially to Mark for all the hard work in putting that together. I told Mark that I think he's got, if he's not already working for him, I think he has a future with National Public Radio. He's got a really good good radio voice. Mark, don't waste your time on CW. You've got a radio voice, old man, and stick with phone. All right, as we were talking about spring before, conditions do seem to be getting better. I think it's partly increased solar activity and partly the equinox. But I now, through the Whisper system, have a direct line to the ionosphere. I have my own personal propagation condition improvement detector here in the shack. The Whisper system is really amazing. And what I do is I sit here all day and sometimes all night pumping out a 20 milliwatt double sideband signal on one very precise frequency on 30 meters with very precise timing. The signal goes out every 2 minutes, beginning on the even 2 minutes. And all stations around the world that are involved in the system are on the same schedule. All of our clocks are synchronized by the internet. So it's an amazing concert of QRP signals rising up as the second hand strikes zero on even numbered minutes. Great stuff. And just thanks again to Joe Taylor for bringing this to us, K1JT. Anyway, when you're running the Whisper system, you become sort of addicted to it, and every once in a while, well, not every once in a while, but lots, you find yourself going to the Whisper database website to see who has been receiving your signals. And like many Whisper addicts, this is how I begin the day. I walk into the shack, I get the coffee going, I turn on the soldering iron, and I turn to the computer and look to see who has detected my Whisper signals. And, you know, usually, up until recently, I would see reports coming in up until about local sunset. I mean, I'd be getting reports all around Europe all day. Every 2 minutes, somebody in Europe or multiple stations are picking up my signal, mostly one skip zone out, sort of northern Germany, Denmark, UK, up into Norway, along those lines. Just basically one hop off the F layer. And that goes on pretty much all day. And then until recently, it stopped right around sunset. And then the band would be dead all night. And then shortly after sunrise over Europe, the festivities would begin again, and stations would start picking me up. It wasn't terribly exciting, but recently I've been noticing that I'm getting reports out from, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 kilometers, crossing the pond with 20 milliwatts of Whisper DSB power. Stations that have been picking me up include W1BW and KB3VR. And usually these reports have been coming in right around local sunrise here. Never local sunset, just local sunrise. Now, I haven't really looked into the gray line conditions or what's going on or how I can explain this, but there you have it, crossing the pond with really low-power DSB. What I usually do when I notice one of these kind of transatlantic events, I go to a website that I've really come to like. It's called spaceweather.com. I recommend it. And sure enough, just about every time that I see something unusual in the propagation pattern, for example, a pond crossing that comes at a kind of unexpected hour, or for me, that occurs at all at this low power level, I check and I can usually find out on that site what was happening on the sun that might have aided the propagation. And it's really kind of an interesting way to follow the ionosphere. I've been looking at some of the the websites associated with Whisper and the chat groups, and people often make the comment that Whisper really puts you in much closer contact with propagation conditions in the ionosphere. You know, when you're just on ordinary normal two-way ham communication, you know, you get a sense of when the band is open and when the band is not. But at Whisper, it's a lot more of a kind of a constant connection to the ionosphere, and you get a better sense of when it's opening and when it's closing. So I think the program is really serving its purpose. WHISPR, of course, stands for Weak Signal Propagation Reporting System, and I think it's doing a great job. It's certainly given me a better understanding of how 30 meters and the ionosphere in general works. It's also I want to say it's gotten me a whole lot more interested in the sun, and this has taken a more kind of disturbing twist lately. Chris Trask, our man in the Sonoran Desert, has recently launched a thread on QRP.L about telescopes, and Chris picked up a used telescope and is thinking about how he can put it to use. Of course, he's thinking how he could put it to use for radio purposes, and he's thinking about turning it into a solar telescope, which made me immediately think, you know, and you guys have been in this situation when somebody else starts talking like this, suddenly a little light bulb goes off in your head and you think, I need a solar telescope. Yeah, I need a solar telescope. How come I don't have a solar telescope? What can I do to get a solar telescope? Or better, what do I have around the house and around the shack that can be turned into a solar telescope? Thanks for that, Chris. I'll keep you posted. But anyway, a lot of fun with WHISPR. Continuing along these lines, I sometimes I get a little bit concerned here that with all this time on with the book and the blog, and I refused to Twitter. I don't tweet. No, that's too much. But all this computer time, I literally have my back to the workbench. I mean, I have all the radios and computers on one side of this little room, and the workbench is behind me. So all the time that I devote to this digital stuff over here, I'm sort of literally with my back turned to the soldering iron and the oscilloscope and the frequency counter and all that. So anyway, I said, enough of this. It's time to melt some solder and build something. And the thing that I decided to build was the W3PM QRSS rig, or actually WHISPR rig. W3PM has a really great schematic. I've talked about it before on the podcast and on the blog, and it's a real simple transceiver for use with WHISPR. And I was intrigued by it for a lot of reasons. I've been almost exclusively transmit only here on WHISPR, and some people have commented that it can't really be considered ham radio if you don't have a receiver. Wes made some comments along those lines, and I agree. So you'll recall that I not too long ago pressed my Drake 2B into service and used the Drake 2B as a WHISPR receiver. Not really the optimal use of Drake 2B technology there, guys. The folks, the engineers in Miamisburg, I don't think they ever intended the Drake 2B to be used with the WHISPR system. So I decided to build something that was more, well, that was intended for use with WHISPR, and W3PM's rig is the perfect thing. Here's a cool thing about it. It's on the receive side, he's got what I guess you could call a direct conversion receiver, but it's a single signal direct conversion receiver, but it doesn't use any of the quadrature techniques used in the more advanced, R2 kind of single signal direct conversion receivers. Because Gene's rig only works on one frequency, you can actually put the filter in the front end, and that's what he does. He using crystals for 10.140 megahertz. You have the local oscillator running at 10.140, and that will give you, with any kind of mixer, that'll give you a direct conversion receiver. But you'll have the audio image. You'll have tuning on both sides of zero beat phenomenon that those of us who use the HW8 are well familiar with. But Gene gets around that because what he does is he takes another crystal for 10.140 and includes it in the what would be the front end bandpass filter. So the bandpass filter on this rig is extremely narrow, narrow enough to chop off one of the sidebands, I think. I think it's that narrow. So I think that's the idea. At the very least, it gets you a very, very narrow passband in the front end and cuts down a lot of the noise getting into the receiver. Anyway, I got inspired. I made use of parts that were sent to me by AL7RV, by Jim, and by Michael AA1TJ. I got to use the power supply that's based on a built around a chip that Tony Fishpool from GQRP sent me. I got to consult with experimental methods in RF design, which was a lot of fun. And it's just been it seems like an all-around a team effort here with great success. Let me look over here. I'm looking at the workbench now. Oh, man, it's percolating along. It's percolating along at 1013872 hertz. Very, very nicely. The thing I like about this little circuit that W3PM's design has is that, you know, I guess this is a matter of laziness, but, you know, with the local oscillator, normally, especially if you're using a diode ring mixer, to get up to the 7 dBm power level that you need for the local oscillator in order to turn the diodes in the diode ring on and off, because that's what the name of the game is with a diode ring mixer. Usually, if you start out with a little FET oscillator, you need one or two stages of amplification after that before you feed the LO energy into the diode ring. Now, you don't have to do this if you're using an NE602, but I've gotten kind of tired of NE602s. More on that in a minute. But anyway, for the diode ring or for any kind of diode-based oscillators, you need a bit of power just to turn those diodes in the mixer on and off. And I get tired of building the buffer and the amplifier. I mean, it's just laziness. And one of the things that attracted me to a Gene circuit was that it's got just one transistor in the LO. He's got a Colpitz oscillator circuit there that puts out sufficient power to drive the diode ring mixer without any additional stages of amplification between the oscillator and the LO port on the mixer. I built this thing. I've got a nice big piece of kind of open copper plate PC board, sort of like a blank canvas. You know, the artist faces the blank canvas, or I guess the writer faces the white page. The solder smoke, the solder melter faces an empty piece of copper clad PC board. And anyway, I built the little Colpitz oscillator smack in the middle of this board. And my intention is to build the receiver circuits up one side of the board and the transmitter circuits on the other side of the board, and have a little relay there to switch power and LO energy between the T and the R sides of the board. Let me tell you guys, it's good to melt solder again. If you're like me and you've been away from it for a while, I recommend it. Even if it's a tiny little project like this, just building one little oscillator stage, it made me feel good. I did it over the weekend, and it was very satisfying. It's good to take a break from all the computer stuff and get back to our solder melting roots. I'll keep you guys informed of this project. I've got a lot of it up on the blog on soldersmoke.blogspot.com, so check that out. I think you'll find it interesting, and take a look at Gene's circuits too. Very, very interesting stuff. Couple final words on Whisper, because I know you guys are probably whispered out at this point. but there's interesting things happening. People have been commenting that there's a lack of Whisper stations in Africa. And one intrepid radio amateur from Austria has done something about this. And he's designed and built a kind of standalone whisper rig that doesn't require a PC, doesn't require internet connections. It just sits there and runs. Not only that, it's multi-band. It hops from band to band. So it's perfect for the whisper kind of propagation study ethos. And two of these stations have been shipped off to Africa. One is currently operating in Namibia, and it's V53 ARC. If you take a look at the whisper maps, you can see it percolating away down there near the Namibian capital. And a second rig has recently been dispatched to Uganda. And I think it's 5X7JD. We've been talking about his activities. There's a lot of information about this on the blog. Check it out. I think the design of the whisper rigs that have been sent are just ingenious. He gets the timing signal from the GPS satellite, so you don't need any kind of broadband 24/7 internet connection for this stuff. Just pulls the timing signal down off the GPS and keeps the rig synchronized with that. Check it out. One final thing, I mentioned that on the WhisperNet website, there's a lot of really interesting information. You can look at maps or databases. You can see how things went different points of time in the past. But I've recently discovered they have a live chat feature on there, and that's really interesting to check out also. They've got some really exotic DX stations popping in on the chat feature, discussing in real time what's happening with their transmission and reception of whisper signals. For example, T61AA is a regular participant. He's in Afghanistan and is active on whisper. So it's I don't say much on that chat system, but it's interesting to kind of lurk and watch the guys discussing what's happening at that moment with the ionosphere. Again, three cheers for Joe Taylor. All right, here, let me take a sip of coffee. I'm getting kind of sore throat here. I don't know why, but let's see, what else? We've been talking about something else here. We've been talking about a guy who I think definitely qualifies for homebrew hero status. And I was led to this individual by the hero of the Hobbit Hole, by the Poet Laureate of QRP, by Michael AA1TJ. Michael was talking about Polyakov Russian mixers. You know, Mike builds all kinds of exotic rigs. I got an email from Steve Smith this morning, you know, saying that he expects Michael to soon come up with a rig that doesn't use any active devices or inactive devices. But one of the circuits that Michael has been quite fond of is known as the Russian mixer. I guess the more technical term for it is a subharmonic mixer, and this is a circuit that was popularized at least in the in the former Soviet Union and in the former Warsaw Pact countries in Eastern Europe by a radio amateur named Vladimir Polyakov, RA3AAE. Vlad, I've heard the term, you know, Polyakov and Polyakov mixers, and I've heard it so often and in such kind of respectful tones that I kind of always assumed that Vlad was back from the early days of radio, and back in the 30s, but I was surprised to discover that he's of much more recent vintage and still active, still on the air, still listed in QRZ.com, and still very much involved in the technical aspects of the hobby. This is a really neat little circuit, and I think for me, I mean, I've seen this circuit in magazines many times over the years, but it's only recently that I've come to really be able to understand it and appreciate it. And in Solder Smoke, Global Adventures in Wireless Electronics, in the book I describe at some length my struggles to understand mixer theory, and I think I've been at least partially successful. Some readers may disagree, But anyway, I think I've made some progress. And anyway, I now when I look at O.M. Polyakov's circuit, now I can see it. I can see what he's doing. And it's really neat. He's got what they call, the way it's described sometimes, especially in the British literature, is anti-parallel diodes. Basically, two ordinary diodes, kind of back-to-back, placed between, with RF going in one end, and the LO signal placed at the other. And what happens is the local oscillator is running at one half the operating frequency, not at the operating frequency, but at one half. And so you have to picture it. It may be helpful at this point to go to the soldersmoke.blogspot.com page and scroll down to some of the circuit diagrams that I've put up about Polyakov mixers, because the fact is that the key to it is that you have these two diodes there, and you got to look at the diodes as switches. The LO signal comes up. The LO is running at one half the operating frequency. Because you've got two diodes there, and the diodes are in parallel, on the positive peak of the LO signal, as soon as that local oscillator signal gets up to around 0.6, 0.7 volts, boom, it turns on one of those diodes. And then when the LO signal drops down below that threshold point, both diodes turn off and remain off until the negative peak. And when that LO signal gets down to a negative 0.6, 0.7 volts, it turns on the other diode. So you have these diodes turning on, think of it as a gate, and the gate is opening not once every cycle, but twice every cycle. So the RF signals that are coming in are being chopped or sampled at twice the frequency of the LO. So the effect is, even though you have the local oscillator running at half the frequency, the effect is identical to having one diode with a local oscillator operating at the desired operating frequency. I hope I've explained that. It's easier with the diagrams. So take a look at that. But it's been really neat talking about this mixer circuit. I found the circuit that had really intrigued me and that I had trouble understanding when I first looked at it a few years ago was one that appeared in Spratt. Of course, I should have known that something ingenious like this would appear in Spratt. But it's a circuit from a German radio amateur that it's sort of a variation on the Polyakov. Sounds sort of like a classical music thing, doesn't it? Anyway, what the German amateur did is he put a switch in the lead to one of the diodes, so that if the switch is on, both diodes are in the circuit and it operates just as I described. But if you open the switch, it takes one of the diodes out of the circuit, and it makes it so that the gate opens only once per LO cycle, and it turns it into an ordinary diode mixer. So with this arrangement, for example, if you have the local oscillator running at 3.5 megahertz and the switch is closed, it becomes a 40-meter receiver. If you open the switch, it becomes an ordinary direct conversion receiver at 3.5 megahertz. So it opens up the possibility of kind of a dual band mixer. Wow, great stuff. Three cheers for Vlad Polyakov and his Russian mixer. I got some nice email. Michael has been in email contact with Vlad and shared with us some kind of interesting personal history. And this is a real kind of a knack story from tough times, guys. You know, we all have our knack stories about how we got into ham radio, and you know, modified a broadcast receiver or scrounged parts or, you know, built up a power supply for an HW32A, all these kind of heroic tales from our periods of being radio youths and all that. So, but I when I heard of, when Michael told me Vlad's story, it really kind of gave me a chill. And the essence of the story, I don't have the details, was that as a kid, Vlad had to scrounge parts for his first ham radio rig out of a out of the wreck of a Wehrmacht tank. I mean, you talk about dangerous dumpster diving. When you get your parts out of a blown up Wehrmacht tank, that's tough stuff, and that's real dedication to the ham radio cause. So, three cheers for Vlad Polyakov, our homebrew hero of the week. All right, guys, we're gonna take a little break here now. We have a band sweep segment sent in to us by Chris KD4 PBJ. It's low band stuff, and we'll put it on now. We'll take a listen. Over to you, Chris.
Hi, Bill. This is Chris, KD4PBJ up in Cumberland, Maryland. I have an interesting band sweep for you this week. This is of the Longwave Band. A lot of hams might not have listened to this. This is down below the AM broadcast band. So I have a 1 meter long brass rod whip. Connected to an active antenna box out in the backyard, hooks into J310 FET and a whole transformer and a few other items. It comes on about 150 feet of coax out here into the shack, and I have a AMRAD up converter. It converts the LF band up to 7 megahertz, and I have that feeding into my Elecraft K2. So we're going to start here with 20 kilohertz. We're getting some digital modulation, and I'll go up till about 350 kilohertz. This is WWVB at 60 kilohertz, the time station. We're up at about 77 kilohertz now. This is Lauren at 100 kilohertz. The main chain went down a couple weeks ago, but I'm still getting part of the Canadian East Coast chain. I think this is from a station in Massachusetts. It's at 100 kilohertz. This is European longwave broadcast. I'm up at about 182 to 184 kilohertz, somewhere in that range. But this is I've gotten this several times from Europe here in North America.
Okay, this is
This is the DIW aviation beacon down in Dixon, North Carolina on 198 kilohertz. Here's another aviation beacon. Now, this is in Canada. The Canada ones have, a lot of them have, it's called DAID. It's a dash after the ID in Morse. So you hear a long dash, and you can tell those are Canadian. Now we're up to about 210 kilohertz. We're hearing the CLB Carolina Beach beacon in North Carolina, and also picking up some European broadcast band. I'm at around 216 kilohertz. There's another Canadian one.
Thanks very much for that, Chris. Very, very interesting. Let's see, a couple other things I wanted to mention. We've been, as a follow-up to my segment on the Russian, not on Russian, on the trip to London, I dug up some of Faraday's toroid diagrams from his original work back in the 1830s. I put that up on the blog. I think you guys will get a kick out of it. What struck me about it was that it's very similar to the drawings that appear in modern ham radio literature. Faraday's drawings of the toroid, his first toroid, the first transformer ever of any kind, remarkably similar to the drawings that you see in the Doug Dumas books on how to put a toroid together. Recently got an email from Roger in the Netherlands, and he's working on how to get his, let me see here if I got any notes on this, but on how to get a toroid wound And it made me think of Faraday's toroid. I think Roger's doing a fine job. He sent me a video of how he was putting the toroids together, and I think he's doing it exactly right. Michael Faraday would approve. Roger, keep up the good work. You know. The one other thing I wanted to mention here before we get to the mailbag, one of the things that I recently had to do with the book was I had to get an ISBN number. The ISBN is the catalog number. You know, on all the books, you look on the back, you see the barcode, and there's a little number there, and it's a registry number for the book. And I recently got an ISBN number for the Solder Smoke book, and put it on the back cover and registered it with the ISBN registry agency. And, well, it was all very bureaucratic. And at one point I was debating whether I really needed to do this or not, and it is debatable, believe me. And I went to look at some of the ham radio books that I have on the shelf here, some of the books that I really like and respect. And one of them is Paul Hardin's Electronic Data Book, NA5N's electronic data book, a real classic, something that deserves a spot on the bookshelves of all true NAC victims. And I said, okay, let me see if Paul got an ISBN for this thing. If you guys have the book, pull it off the shelf and take a look. And you flip it over, and on the back, there's sort of this barcode, but it looks a bit, as the Brits would say, it looks a bit wonky. The thing about barcodes is they got to be lined up, and all the lines got to be straight. You know, it just doesn't. And these lines, they didn't look quite straight or quite parallel. And if you look closer at the ISBN on Paul's electronic data book, you'll see that he has written where the numbers should be. And he's explaining the kind of wiggly, wobbly lines that appear below. It says, leftover resistor leads. So he just went around the workbench and picked up all the little bits of resistor leads that you have around, lined them up, and used that in his spoof of the ISBN barcode. Three cheers for Paul Hardin. Yeah. We don't need no stinking ISBNs. All right, okay. Gentlemen, it's now time for...
Solder Smoke Mailbag.
That's awesome.
Indeed. Yeah, Solder Smoke Mailbag. All right, let's see. A lot of mails come in because it's been so long. Let's see, start out here. Colin M0, CGH. Is a real NAC victim. He got his start with crystal radios as a kid. And Colin, I'm sorry, I've read the report on you, and you are truly a hopeless case, old man. You've got the knack. You've got it bad. There is no cure. Deal with it. Frank KO9K reports that Agilent, a company called Agilent, is selling nice oscilloscopes from a company called Rigol. And they're priced at around $400. I took a look. It does indeed look very nice. Those of you who are in the market for a new scope, you might want to check that out. Thanks for sending that along. Nick, G8INE, was commenting on the Solder Smoke segment in which I described ENG3ROO's code key collection. And one of the keys that Ian showed me was a little spark key for a spark rig, but it was completely encased in, and you had to look at the little spark element through a little window in the key. And the guys out there in Dover explained to me that this was a special telegraph key for use with hydrogen balloons, where, you know, the spark could be, well, a bit problematic. Nick comments on this, and he said that near his home is the site of a crash of a German airship from the war. I guess it was World War I. German airship L-33 crashed near his home, and he writes that in the days of the old airships, and I didn't know this, but when they were above, when the airship got above the clouds and they needed to get below the clouds, which is, of course, those of you who've done anything with aviation know is a real problem if you don't have the proper instruments. In the old days, what they had on the airship was a little gondola that they would put somebody in with a telephone and lower him down through the clouds so that hopefully he'd be able to take a peek and tell them that they were not about to crash into a mountain or something. Boy, you want to talk about tough duty. Holy cow, if you're the guy in the gondola underneath the hydrogen-fueled airship, you might have made some bad career choices along the way. Totally, and no pun intended here, but after describing this and talking about the spark coil telegraph key, Nick comments on some new candy tins that are available from the esteemed British store Marks and Spencer. I was in the UK long enough to refer to this store, this chain, as Marks and Sparks. A little bit of Cockney rhyming slang here this morning. Anyway, and he notes that Marks and Sparks tins are kind of what he refers to as, and this is what shocked me, as a British alternative to Altoids tins. Nick, there's nothing more British than Altoids tins. This is part of the British heritage, and certainly part of the British QRP heritage. I mean, those Altoids tins they've got on the cover, this very British, a curiously refreshing mint. Very kind of understated British advertising. Yeah, so as far as I know, Altoids are 100% British, and I hope nobody's going to, you know, burst my bubble by telling me that they were being produced in Canton, Ohio, or something like that. No, the Altoids, they're definitely British. Chris, KD4PBJ, the fellow who sent us the band sweep segment, also sent me a nice email noting that he had built a Trivial Electric motor back in 2006. Hey, me too, Chris, and I built one again. Your email prompted me to build another one. One of Billy's friends was over, and I needed to do something technically spectacular, so I rebuilt the Trivial Electric motor. If any of you are interested in this, we have a video up on it on the video page associated with the website. If you go along the right hand side of the blog page, you'll find a video link, and it'll take you to my video page where the Trivial Electric motor page is up. This is amazing. I looked at the hit count on the Trivial Electric motor page, and over 50,000 people have looked at this little video. It's only been up there a few years, but it's had 50,000 views. I think Alan VK2ZAY down there in Australia for getting me into the Trivial Electric motor business. This is the my first contact with Alan was about this project, and he was the one who gave me the idea. So thanks for that, Alan. Neil, and thanks for writing in on that, Chris. Neil, WA4CHQ, it was brought into the QRP world by Wes, W7ZOI's Mountaineer project. He strayed away from the solder smoke for a while, but the podcast has brought him back to the knack. All right, Neil. Glad you're back. Stick with it. Pete, VE2XPL, writes in from Montreal. He talks about some of his favorite moments in solder smoke, and he says that one of his favorite is the quote from Billy when we were standing out there in front of St. Peter's Basilica on Christmas Day, and the Pope was greeting everybody in all the languages, and Billy looked up at one point and said, "What? No Klingon?" I like that one too, Pete, but of course I'm biased. He also he liked the movie Up, but we won't go into details there, and he says he's a bit ashamed to admit that the movie provoked an emotional reaction in him. Well, don't feel bad, Pete. We were all moved by Up. And he also said that he recently tried to summit a 400-foot peak 400 feet. Is that really a peak for some VHF DX? But it was a no-go because his 4-year-old had other plans. That's the way it goes, Pete. And I guess you know when you have a 4-year-old, a 400-foot mountain is a peak. But I think you made the right choice. You got to take care of the kid there. The mountain will be there. You'll summit that mountain some other time. Thanks for sending the email in. Moj, we got an email from Moj, W8MOJ. Moj is the musical genius behind the theme song for Solder Smoke out there in Ohio, and he's been helping me track down the elusive Varactor diode receiver that I tried to build and failed. You know, so many guys have tried to help me. Thanks, Moj. Thanks for everybody who's helped me try to find the schematic for this rig. I'm about ready to give up. The closest thing I've seen is the receiver that was supposed to be kind of a part of the Tuna Tin series, and it was a receiver known as the Herringbone. Get it? Herringbone. And there's a QST article about it. I've seen it. I've looked at it. The circuit looks remarkably similar to what I built. But the one thing I can't figure out is that I don't remember ever working with kind of the template for the PC board. One of the reasons I think I had problems with this rig was that I just threw together a PC board kind of willy-nilly and had a lot of inputs, a lot of gazintas too close to gazautas and inputs too close to outputs and just kind of a haphazard arrangement of the circuit on the board. I remember I built a board. I remember getting my fingers, you know, stained with the PC etchant from Radio Shack. But I don't think there was too much of a rhyme or reason to my design of the PC board. And I think that's one of the things that got me in trouble. I know the Herringbone article had a really nice diagram for the oval shaped PC board that would fit on top of the Herringbone can. And I wonder why I didn't use that. So I might have been dealing with an earlier article about this receiver that perhaps didn't have the PC board layout on it. But thanks, Moj, for helping me track that down. And I might just go ahead and build the Herringbone and declare it the project to be completed after, what, 30 years? There was an email, guys, that came across the QRPL list. It wasn't really directed at me, but it was directed at all of us. And it really cracked me up. It was from Charles W. D8AXA. And the title of the email message was, "Let's Be Cool at Dayton." Let's be cool at Dayton. Charles, in the email, describes how he recently picked up a kit called the Retro 75 kit. Apparently it's an AM kind of rig. He's going to build it in some sort of enclosure that sounds sort of like a Benton Harbor lunchbox. He's going to fire it up on 3885 kilohertz, or kilocycles, I should say, because we're in the retro mode, and he's going to put it on the Milnet frequency. And Charles thinks that this is going to make him really cool at Dayton. I think there's a definite cool element to it, but I think Charles is getting a bit carried away, because the last line of his message says that he invites other people to join him in his coolness, and he says that he suggests that they could even go out and, quote, talk about chicks and stuff at the flea market. These are the cool guys. Good luck with that, Charles. You're walking around with a 75-meter AM transceiver in a lunchbox. Cool is going to be a real challenge, old man. But I hear you. Recently got some nice email from Lee, G0IAY. He moves back and forth from the UK to Beijing for work. This is an interesting travel routine. He listens to Solder Smoke on the way there and on the way back. Glad to accompany you on that long trip there, Lee. I was just interested to see how much of our digital emissions here make it into China. And surprise, Lee says that The Solder Smoke podcasts are available freely in China, and no problem there. The blog doesn't make it through, though. For some reason, you can't get the blog in China. But we're pleased to know that that the Solder Smoke podcast is making it through, and hope it's being of use to our solder melting brothers there in China. The guy who was winding the toroids, I lost his call, but here it is. Roger PA1ZZ, a frequent contributor to the podcast and to the blog, and good luck there with the toroids. Like I said, I think you're on the right track. Keith VE3TFZ sent us a very interesting email. Thanks for that, Keith. He found Solder Smoke while doing a web search for Gene Shepard. Very appropriate. He found us. He also listens to Ted Randall's QSO radio show. And here's where I get jealous. Not that he's listening to another podcast. That's okay. There was a recent... by the way, there was a recent kind of discussion on QRPL. Somebody had asked about other podcasts and a number of loyal... perhaps a bit too loyal Solder Smoke listeners questioned the loyalty of someone who would ask that question. Look, there are other podcasts out there, guys, and it's okay with me if you listen to them. But here's the part that gets me jealous. This Ted Randall fella with his QSO radio show, I'm sure it's excellent, but he's being broadcast on shortwave on WBCQ. This is what I wanted to do. I want to actually be wiggling the ether on the shortwave bands with Solder Smoke. So if anybody out there has any connections in the shortwave world, please use them. Let's get Solder Smoke into the ether. Enough of this fiber optic cable stuff. We'll stay on the fiber optic cable, but this show really needs to be broadcast. And we've got, 123 episodes now? This could keep a broadcast station in business for years. And I'm happy to make it available. So if anybody out there has any connections with shortwave broadcast stations or medium wave broadcast stations or FM broadcast stations, please put in a word for Solder Smoke, because it would be fun to know that it was also out there actually being transmitted by radio. I know it's on some 2-meter FM repeater systems, but I think we need to make the break into the broadcast world. I think the public needs to know about this. Perhaps the Oprah appearance will help in this regard. We'll see. Stay tuned. Keith mentions that in Tony Randall's program, he did an interview with Jeff Murray, the ham radio cartoonist. And Jeff has a really amazing series of cartoons. What a talented guy. I visited his websites. And really great stuff. One of the cartoons, the cartoon character that he deals with is Dash, the dog-faced ham. Great stuff. And Keith sent me one particular cartoon that has to do with Solder Smoke and solder, well, not the program, but soldering and using old equipment and everything else. So thanks for sharing that with us, Keith. And guys, do something here about this shortwave broadcast situation. I know somebody out there must have some pull with the suits that run the shortwave stations. Finally, last bit of email comes from Australia. John VK3AJG found some great Russian books and websites with lots of information about direct conversion receivers, and he shares that with us. And even though they're in Russian, he says that Google Translate is doing amazing things. So he says that we should take a look at some of those sites. I'll try to get them up on the blog so you guys can take a look. Oh yeah, one last thing. I meant to mention this, and John's email reminded me. You know, I said that in my latest project, I consulted with EMRFD. And I actually did so right out in front of the Pantheon while waiting for Billy to come out of his fencing classes. But Thing is, I was trying to understand. I wanted to get more information on direct conversion receivers, and so I brought with me EMRFD. Chapter 8 in the EMRFD, I mean, the whole thing is just magnificent, but Chapter 8 is particularly good, and it deals with direct conversion receivers and a really good treatment of DC receivers. Although, I must say, I think Wes deserved a little bit more credit there for his 1968 article in QST. But the whole Chapter 8 thing is really great. I really like it, and it gives a lot of the history of kind of receiver technology and why at different points in history hams were using different kinds of receivers. And but there's one note here, and I got a kick out of this. It's one subsection of Chapter 8 called Direct Aversion. Direct aversion. And I'll read you a bit of it. Before proceeding with the technical discussion, it is worthwhile to note that many otherwise rational human beings have an emotional aversion to direct conversion receivers. Guys, in my case, we know that the aversion is focused completely on regens. I love DC receivers. It's regens that I have the emotional aversion to. Anyway, let me continue. The basic block diagram is so simple and appealing that many unsuspecting designer builders and engineering managers have fallen into the trap of believing that direct conversion is the holy grail of receivers, able to outperform the old obsolete super heterodyne architecture at a fraction of the cost. Most attempts to build something cheaper and better than an existing mature technology will fail when the holy grail turns out to be a cracked clay cup. The designer involved may end up with a lingering bad taste in his mouth. Experienced professional and amateur technical writers tend to either love or hate direct conversion receivers, and this bias has often appeared in print. Guys, we love them. Here at Solder Smoke, we love direct conversion receivers, so we're not guilty of direct aversion. We are definitely guilty of regen aversion because, as you know, I've declared them to be basically possessed and linked to the, as we say here in Rome, the other place. Enough of that, guys. Be sure to check out the Oprah broadcast, and I'll have the website up there. It'll be, let's see, www.soldersmoke.com/Oprah. Be sure to tune in. 7-3s from Rome.